Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on the show, we're digging into the issue of urban crime with our guest, David Kennedy. David is a criminologist and professor at the John Jay College in New York, but his fieldwork in troubled neighborhoods has revolutionized law enforcement and made cities safer. And with the economy tanking and retail especially taking a hit, we'll find out how one neighborhood is working to bring small business to its main street. Yavaka Young of Main Street Anacostia is our guest. Stick around for Smart City with our City Views commentator Walker Smith and Nate Berg from Plan Edison coming up after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Many neighborhoods and cities worldwide still struggle with violent crime, and traditional police enforcement can make the problem worse by turning the neighborhood against those who seek to protect it. My first guest, David Kennedy, has turned conventional wisdom of law enforcement on its head. His astounding research in troubled neighborhoods has produced staggering drops in violent crime and a new way for law enforcement to make neighborhoods safer. David, what do we know about what works in reducing crime in troubled communities?
I think we know two things. We used to treat crime like the weather, and we would just watch it happen and try to clean up afterward. We don't have to do that anymore. So the big news is there are absolutely things that cities can do that make a big difference in crime. And the New York story is obviously the biggest national one there. Homicide has come down in New York City by something like 75%. And no matter what else is going on in the rest of the country or other big cities, New York consistently controls its crime problem. Beyond that, on a couple of fronts, namely really serious urban violence and the open-air drug markets that tend to travel with that violence, we can have very quickly very dramatic impact on those issues, actually in ways that strengthen the affected communities, keep people out of prison, help them become legitimate and productive. And it's sounds too good to be true, but it's really good news for everybody involved.
Well, the natural next question then is, how did New York do what it did? What are the things that we can, in fact, do to reduce crime? And what are the things we can do to make a difference in drug markets in cities?
Well, let's start with the serious violence and the drug markets, which are really aspects of the same thing. Where you find really high levels of violence, and that's street, gun, associated with open-air drug dealing, all that kind of thing. What turns out to be true no matter where you go is that it is a very small number of very criminally active groups that drive the violence. And we can call those gangs, we can call them anything we want. Arguing about what the definitions are doesn't matter very much and doesn't help very much. What matters is that this violence comes out of groups. So in recent work we've done in Cincinnati, for example, 48 groups with under 1,100 people in them representing 0.3% of the city's population are associated with 75% of the homicides.
That's incredible.
It is extraordinary, except there's nothing special about Cincinnati in that respect anywhere. That's what you get. And those are also the groups that do, aside from the violence, the most corrosive thing that can happen in a community, which is the public drug dealing. The crack houses, the guys on corners, the drive-through buyers from out of the neighborhood, the robberies and burglaries and car breaks and prostitution that travel with that, the kids with guns taking over public spaces. All of that is associated with this very, very small population of extraordinarily active groups. And what we've learned is that you can shut down the violence and then you can shut down the drug markets. So to shut down the violence, you get a message out to all of the groups that their community needs the violence to stop, that they are better than this, but while they are loved, their behavior is rejected, that for the very small number of people in any community doing this, there is a special helping structure for them, that if they want it, will help them get remedial education and job training and job placement and drug treatment and emergency assistance and all that kind of thing. And that this is not a negotiation, and the community and the city is not asking. The violence is going to stop. And that the first group in the city that kills somebody, go home and pack your bags, because you are committing all kinds of crimes constantly. And if you want the authorities going through your life with a fine-tooth comb, let somebody you run with pull a trigger on somebody. We will come after you for drug dealing, warrants, probation and parole violations, other crimes, open cases, unpaid child support, unregistered cars, everything. And when the groups come to believe that there will be collective accountability for the violence, they start policing one another. And you actually get the group controlling its own violent behavior. This is fact, right? This has been done for 15 years almost all over the country, and you stick with it and it works.
Where has it worked?
As part of my work at the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at John Jay, we actually put together a list recently of currently active jurisdictions doing either this violence prevention or the drug market work. Our list right now is 75 jurisdictions around the country currently doing these strategies. So Boston, Indianapolis, Chicago, a bunch of places in North Carolina, Minneapolis, early start projects in Baltimore and Los Angeles. It's actually a really long list right now.
And what has to happen in a community? I mean, you've described it generally, but how do you get all the parties on board? I'm always struck, David, by newspaper reports of a shooting, and then a culprit is found. And these are usually, again, young people. And according to their families, no one's ever in a gang. No one. No one's ever in a gang. According, they were always sweet boys. They were always good boys. They weren't a gang. So how in the world do you get all the parties to the table and get the community in particular to say enough?
What the community needs to know is that there's going to be a different deal. Right now, the community is in a position in which the only external attention, for all practical purposes, to these issues comes in the form of law enforcement arresting their kids. And you probably know this. I think a lot of our general public does not know this. 30 years ago in this country, we had 250,000 people in prison. Right now, we have 2.2 million people in prison. More people in prison in this country than in China, with 1.3 billion population. We imprison at a higher rate than any other developed country by a huge factor. And most of the prison coming and going comes from the communities we're talking about. This is not evenly distributed. And what the community is used to is people on the outside saying, you have a crime problem, we're going to come in and we are going to arrest everybody. And you get communities in which the majority of young men have criminal records. Those are young men who no longer have any reason to finish school. There's no point in their taking entry-level jobs. Going to jail becomes normal. It becomes a rite of passage. The police are seen as an occupying army. Many in the community think that the law enforcement is an excuse for the same sort of outside racist oppression that has, in fact, been visited upon the community historically. I work with Black elders who remember from their childhood sheriffs in Klan's robes coming into their homes to lynch their grandparents. And there's a very, very powerful narrative in the community that says, especially drug enforcement is just the most recent excuse, just like always, for the outside to come in and use law to keep the community down. So the first thing we need to do is understand that when those of us on the outside hear from the community things that everybody knows isn't true, nobody's in a gang, everybody's innocent, what we're really hearing is this deep, deep, deep historical anger and present dissatisfaction with the way we outsiders are addressing these issues.
And how can that be overcome?
Well, law enforcement needs to understand that when the way they operate leaves all the young men in a community with a criminal record, you have now destroyed this community. Those are people who will never be able to have successful lives. And this is not about innocence or profiling or abuse or perjury or any of those usual critiques of law enforcement. Look, I work in these communities. The crime is real. The arrests are real. But the fact is, if we continue to try to address crime with these very intrusive, high arrest, high incarceration policies, we are destroying the village in order to save it. And we are polarizing those who should be our natural allies, the, we'll call them, good people in the community. So we need a different way to do law enforcement. At the same time, the community needs to understand that when the only people that the guys on the corner are hearing say the drugs and the violence are wrong, when the only people saying that are people in uniform from the outside, that has no standing in their eyes. Nobody can set standards for a community from the outside. And the fact is, right now, the streets don't hear any crisp, steady message that they respect saying, don't do this. What we've learned is that you can meet in the middle. Law enforcement can say, we will bend over backwards not to arrest people, but we all know what's going on. And if the community doesn't step up and say to them, this is wrong, we can't have it, we're going to have to arrest them. So let's get together. Let's focus on the very few people that are doing this. Let's try to help them. Let's make it very clear what's acceptable and what's not. And then if they don't comply, then we go to law enforcement. And it turns out that is just unbelievably effective.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Kennedy of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. I want to come back to an earlier part of our discussion. You, when I said gangs and you said gangs or groups or whatever you call it, it doesn't matter. I'm really curious about the term gangs and what it means. I've wondered at times, have we somehow elevated the idea of gangs in a way that we've elevated the word terror, and perhaps it keeps us from dealing with it in a smart way. What's your view of gangs and whether that terminology or the way we imagine gangs, those of us who are not in them, we don't live in the neighborhoods that sort of experience this problem on a day-to-day basis, what should we be thinking about what the media call gangs?
If I could ban the word from the English language, I would happily do it.
Oh, really?
It makes us all really stupid. If you go to an academic conference on gangs, which is a punishment I would not wish on anybody, the debate about what defines a gang starts on Thursday night at dinner. It continues through the proceedings Friday, Saturday, and Sunday morning. People leave for the airport at the end of the conference still arguing, and then everybody gets together the next year and does it again. It doesn't help us think about any of this. What does matter is that what we're dealing with is a group, and trying to figure out where a group turns into a gang and vice versa just gets us absolutely nowhere. But these groups of offenders egg each other on. They impose informal standard on each other. People perform for each other. They get in group-on-group vendettas in which the individuals involved don't matter very much. What matters is that this group feels that it has an enemy and the other group feels the same way. And so you get these Hatfield and McCoy back and forth things. What most people mean by gang is purposeful, organized, leadership, turf, kind of rules of entry and exit, all that kind of thing. And almost always, that's not what's going on. I tell people, don't think General Motors, think kick the can.
Mm-hmm.
This image of purposeful directed criminal enterprises using violence to protect their business interests is almost always a cartoon. What you get is a bunch of guys, they came up together very often. There's very little in the way of leadership. There's no business plan. There's no sort of rules of engagement. Almost all the violence is personal. This is one of the big mistakes we make, that they're a gang, they're selling drugs, they're hustling, there's a lot of violence. Obviously, that's in defense of their money and their markets. 80-90% of the time, it is entirely personal. It's respect, it's disrespect, it's these back and forth beefs that nobody can remember how they started. It's boy-girl stuff. If it were about business, there'd be a lot less of it, because actually it draws attention and it's bad for business.
Yeah, bad for business, right. That makes sense.
And even the more organized, and I use that very loosely with very rare exceptions, even what we think of as organized, Crips, Bloods, people, folk, you look at what's going on at any particular time in any particular neighborhood, and it is crazy street-level personal chaos.
Mm. Let me just make sure, David, I understand the implications of what you're saying. You think that we've destroyed the village by putting too many people in jail, and yet you say the violence is very real and needs to be stopped. So help me through sort of bottom line here. What are we talking about in terms of effective strategies to reduce the crime and keep people out of jail at the same time?
So if we are able to convince all the groups in a city that they really don't want to be the next group that kills somebody, because the whole group is going to suffer for that. If we have driven that message home and if it is believed, then there will be very little violence and we don't have to arrest a lot of people.
Gotcha. So the whole group experiencing that, meaning that's when you're saying throw the book at everything, child support.
Now this doesn't mean that there isn't a crucial role for law enforcement. There is. But what we want law enforcement to do is deliver a credible message that people on the street believe. And when it's believed, you don't have to deliver on it very often.
Right. And so how do you convince law enforcement to take that approach versus the one that is more typical?
Well, it's taken about 15 years, but the word's getting out. And this is not really news any longer in law enforcement. I think in the media and the public and in political circles, that's not so well understood right now. But people in law enforcement increasingly understand that this really is very effective. If you're working in a drug market, and this seems absolutely upside down and inside out, but in fact it makes sense. If you're working in a drug market and you investigate every drug dealer in that drug market, you have a case ready to go against each of them. You sit down, you look at everybody's record, you figure out who's violent. Nobody's going to take a chance on those guys. So they get arrested, they get prosecuted, just like always. But that usually leaves half, three quarters of all the dealers. And if instead of arresting them, which we know ruins their life forever, angers their family, angers their community, we go and talk to their mother and say, your son's in real trouble, there's going to be a meeting, please come to the meeting, bring your son. Everybody shows up. And you show them the videotape of the surveillance pictures of their son selling drugs. You say to the drug dealers, gentlemen, when you see yourself committing a felony, please raise your hand. Law enforcement says, your community needs you to stop. We want to work with them. There's help for you. We want you to take it. But we're not asking. And if you go sell drugs again, it will be immediately apparent to us. We have a case ready to go. We will activate that case. We will take you away. And that is so sure and certain that you have to be an idiot to go do that. And not very many people do, which means they don't have to get arrested.
So this works, and it's working in a number of communities.
Yep.
Why is the prison population continuing to rise?
Because we haven't got this out far enough, fast enough. And that's now that we know that it works, that's the next job.
Let me ask you what may seem like an aside, and to some extent it is. Do you favor decriminalization of drugs or drug offenses at some level?
You know, I had to take the subway to get from John Jay to the studio today. I would really rather have walked outside my office and flapped my arms and flown here, but I can't do that. So I don't know why we want to talk about decriminalization. We all know it's not going to happen, and it's just a distraction from doing the hard work that's in front of us.
So you think even marijuana, that's not even on the table realistically? It's like flapping your wings?
Of course it's not. This country is not going to decriminalize anything. We know that. It's like talking about dealing with the violence by saying, oh, let's get rid of the guns.
Okay, well, let's take that one, because a lot of people, let's face it, I mean, we have, oh my gosh, gun turn-ins all the time. Bring us your gun, we'll pay you money, or we'll give you a certificate for something.
Helps a lot, doesn't it?
Well, why do politicians keep doing it? Looks good, sounds good?
It seems like it makes sense. It is something to do. It's making a statement. A lot of the people behind those programs actually think that they work. They don't work. And people don't focus on what will work.
And so in the simplest possible terms, if you were advising our listeners, who are all members of communities, what is the message they should take in simplest possible form to their elected officials to say, we've got to cut the crime in our town? We want you to try this strategy or this set of strategies. What's the message?
There are two problems that we need to solve. They're opposite faces of the same coin. We need to prevent serious crime and violence. We need to do something about mass incarceration. The way we have been fighting crime has alienated the community that itself is the key to crime prevention. There is no stronger crime prevention than all the righteous people in a community saying with one voice, not here. We have put the community in a position where if they say not here, they are throwing their own children away, and no community will do that. So we need to find what is in fact very strong common ground here, which in our historical alienation, we can't usually see. Everybody, even the guys on the street, wants the streets to be safe. Everybody wants anybody who will take it to get a helping hand, no matter how old and seasoned they are. Even the guys on the street want the most violent predators corralled. Nobody wants to put anybody in jail who doesn't absolutely have to go there. Everybody would rather that community standards take the place of heavy-handed policing. And everybody needs, at the end of the day, to know that law enforcement is there if they have to step in and play cleanup. Almost nobody disagrees with any of this, but we can't see it, and therefore we continue to sort of push each other into these terrible corners.
Well, you make a really compelling case. Who is the most effective police commissioner in the nation?
Well, I will do a shout-out to my very good friend Jim Faley in High Point, North Carolina, who has really pioneered a lot of this and who has shown the most exceptional courage in being willing to face the almost unfaceable racial tensions that are built into all of this and to see them clearly and make his way through them and talk across these divides. He has really open the door for all the rest of us.
And what about big city commissioners?
There is nobody like Bill Bratton, as we all know, who's in L.A. now.
And is he having good success there?
He's making headway in a very, very difficult environment. Yep.
David, you're doing important work. Thanks so much for taking time to share it with us today on Smart City.
Thanks for asking.
David Kennedy is the director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control and professor of anthropology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. His interview was engineered by Andrew Krivanis. Coming up in the second half of Smart City, we'll talk about neighborhoods on the mend with Yavaka Young of Main Street Anacostia. I'm Carol Coletta. Hello to our podcast listeners. I just had a quick note about some of the conversations that are happening on our social networking site, My City. Our listeners are continuing to talk about the topics we bring up on the show.
From rent control to mass transit, from your favorite online urbanism tools to why you choose to live in the city in the first place. My City is a place where people who love cities can meet and chat and get great new ideas. Please join us. Send an email to our producer, Scotty Iseri, at scotty@smartcityradio.com. He'll get you all set up. And now, back to the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. For the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
In a move that's been applauded by pedestrians, urbanists, and livable streets advocates across the country, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Transportation Commissioner Jeanette Sadiq Khan have announced plans to block vehicle traffic on a large portion of Broadway in Midtown Manhattan. The proposed section of street closure buffers Times Square, and officials are planning to put the wheels in motion as early as May, according to an article in the New York Times. The intention is to create more pedestrian-friendly areas within the city, and also to improve traffic flows. Broadway runs diagonally across the city's modern grid street pattern, so planners are hoping the closure will eliminate the clogs the intersections have created near Times Square. Some critics fear businesses will suffer as a result of the closure, but many others say this is a commendable move for the pedestrians of New York City. The experimental closure is set to last until the end of the year for evaluation. Meanwhile, another controversial idea is getting some major support at high levels. The National Surface Transportation Infrastructure Financing Commission has advised Congress to raise the federal gas tax and begin a conversion to a fee based on vehicle miles traveled. The New York Times reports that the commission is calling for an additional 10 cents in federal taxes on every gallon of gas and an additional 15 cents on diesel fuel. The move is necessary, they say, to fund the nation's aging transportation infrastructure, which has fallen into a, quote, crisis of neglect. Transitioning to a VMT-based fee has been touted recently as a more effective way to raise the money needed to pay for road and transportation projects. But despite a mention of support from Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, President Barack Obama has reportedly shot down both options. There are plenty of transportation projects, however, that the Obama administration is squarely in favor of. As officials look at ways to create jobs and boost the economy, rebuilding transportation infrastructure is high on the list. In an address to the Department of Transportation, President Obama announced that the economic stimulus plans focus on transportation projects would save or create 150,000 jobs by the end of 2010, the majority of them in the private sector. Though the breakdown of the actual jobs created puts only about 95,000 in direct relation to transportation projects, the mere creation of those jobs is projected to boost other sectors of the economy, such as the goods and services that will be needed by new workers. But for many Americans struggling through the economic recession, the purpose of new jobs is likely less important than the quantity. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for PlanEdison.com. Anacostia is a historic neighborhood in Washington, D.C. In the past, it's had a history as a rough place, not enjoying the renaissance of the rest of the district, but now the area is coming back, and it's doing so with the help of the not-for-profit organization Main Street Anacostia. Yavaka Young is the organization's executive director, and she joins us from her bustling and a little noisy office to tell us how she's not just building a stronger retail corridor for Anacostia, she's building a neighborhood. With the economy tanking and retail especially taking a hit, what are you doing today to foster economic development and improve the Anacostia business corridor?
Well, the District of Columbia has been very gracious in terms of thinking about business retention in the city. A few years ago, the city brought Main Street's programs to D.C. It's a national model. It comes out of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And for all of the Main Street programs in the city, and right now there are about 10, and it includes several new ones that just got started this year. But the idea is to bring back or revitalize neighborhood retail. And the focus this year, over the last fiscal year, was business retention. And the city provided various grant monies to help existing businesses to stay in business. One thing that was done was commercial facade improvements, also sort of technical assistance to the restaurants and eateries in our area. We had a consultant come in and do an assessment, and then we tried to come back and implement some of the recommendations. We've done all sorts of promotional activities, created a video piece about our transitioning commercial corridor and about the opportunities here and about some of the great businesses we have. So things like that have gone a long way, not only to bring more business to the area, but also to give small business owners a boost or an increased level of confidence during tough times. You know, one of our merchants, his window got broken. We had funds to be able to fix that. Now, I know it's only $200 or $300, but you're basically trying to make ends meet, and something like that happens, and, you know, there is a support system in place to cover that.
Describe the location of Anacostia in D.C. and how it relates to the rest of Washington.
Well, Anacostia originally was sort of a suburb of D.C. It's a little smaller scale than downtown and even Capitol Hill. We've got about 60 storefronts. About 45 of them are actually occupied. So it's a small commercial area, but it is an historic district. Right now we do have a couple of government agencies that have offices, 100 or 200 employees. So we do have a little bustling economy during the week. However, during the urban renewal decades of the 60s and 70s, the neighborhood that had previously been sort of working class, very strong neighborhood, the urban renewal program basically changed that. It created a very different kind of a socioeconomic condition on this side of D.C. and actually encompasses two wards, not Anacostia, but what we call the greater east of the river, where a lot of the urban renewal programs were placed. And as a result, during the next few decades, really up to the year 2000, Anacostia struggled economically. There was increased crime. There were all kinds of, you know, things happening in this neighborhood. So the fact that the city has now an increased effort to revitalize neighborhood businesses has definitely created a lot of great changes for Ward 8. Washington, D.C. has 8 wards. Ward 8 is sort of on the boundary of Maryland, so between Capitol Hill and Maryland, the state of Maryland.
Well, let me ask you about neighborhood retail, because when we think of retail today, we think of Target and Costco and the big boxes. How does neighborhood retail, first of all, what constitutes neighborhood retail, and what sorts of businesses can thrive at that level?
Well, I mean, I know a lot of people, when you're thinking about, you know, urban revitalization, they don't think of, you know, big boxes as, you know, something that is attractive. But big boxes do create well-known stores located in an area. They create a lot of retail traffic. So even the big boxes are creating models that can fit in more urban areas. You know, you can have a two-level Target in Brooklyn, you know, in other places. So, you know, I don't necessarily think that having the name brand stores is a disincentive in any way. But what neighborhood retail can do is give entry-level entrepreneurs an opportunity to begin to build business. Also, it creates sort of more of a boutique feel. Sometimes it can be a more upscale feel. It is definitely more attractive to tourists when you have more boutique retail. You know, you don't go out of town to shop at TJ Maxx. It can create lots of interest, and it's a way to bring more character to your urban neighborhood.
Well, it's certainly all of that, but I'm curious, what are the mistakes that you typically see neighborhood retailers make?
Well, I mean, any business, I mean, we know statistics about business and how, you know, the very large percentage of them fail within the first 5 years. And I don't know that retailers are different in terms of failure rates. But one mistake that they could make is not knowing the market. Here, demographically, our residential market is maybe not as wealthy as the office market. And those of us in the industry also, you know, we have not figured out a new way to create a market analysis that goes beyond the residential population. And so we should do that. And I think our commercial district is much more attractive when you do look at the office market, and increasingly so. We just had the city's Department of Housing and Community Development to move into one of our brand new office spaces. They're only bringing 200 employees, but, you know, they need lunch, a cup of coffee. They may want to bring their dry cleaning and drop it off and take it home on the way home. And they also may want to live close to where they work.
Do you see workers today shopping during the day, or is an office market, as you say, more of a service and restaurant market?
Well, it depends. If those workers are women, they're shopping during the day.
Are they?
Well, I mean, it depends if there's a great place to shop. I know when I worked downtown, we certainly took a lunch hour to, you know, to go and shop. So I don't think that would be a surprise to anybody.
Okay, the great American pastime, or used to be. I wonder what people are going to do with their time now that they're not shopping as much. You've described Anacostia and Ward 8, but, you know, thanks to federal spending, Washington, D.C. is one of the America's most robust markets. It's still very insulated from the kind of economic downturn the rest of the world is experiencing. What does that mean specifically for Anacostia? I know you've been one of the last neighborhoods to enjoy some of the sort of broader Washington wealth. What's it like today?
Well, I mean, let me say, before the country experienced its economic downturn and, you know, the jobless rate went up, our jobless rate here has hovered between 13 and 15% for at least the last 10 years. So the country's economic crisis has been this ward's economic crisis. We are, you know, certainly have not been sheltered by, you know, having a robust city. What the ward has benefited from, however, is tax dollars that have gone to create social programs and to kind of offset some of the socioeconomic problems that we have had with the economy's downturn and most of the local government jurisdictions being over budget. I imagine that some of the money for social programs will get squeezed, just like everything else has. You know, obviously, if you're not taking in the same kind of tax dollars, then you can't support various programs.
Is there a formula for a successful Main Street, and in this case, a successful neighborhood Main Street or neighborhood commercial district?
Well, I definitely think that cities should look at Main Street programs as an opportunity to create more wealth building, and in such, consider it an investment. So I think maybe to reevaluate the way the jurisdiction spends money in more inner city areas where typically it's gone to social programs, to sort of look at programs that can bring an economic return or that can produce an economic return. And certainly the Main Street programs, you know, do that. They also, you know, they add to a quality of life. They help people to think differently about their neighborhoods. One thing the City District of Columbia did this year is give Main Street programs and business improvement districts an opportunity to get a grant for a daily clean team. And so that certainly has added to the quality of life of our little neighborhood downtown in that it's clean. And so when places are clean, people tend to not trash them up as much because it's clean. Now, if it's dirty, you know, then it doesn't matter if I throw another piece of trash down, it's already dirty. Again, I think making investments in commercial revitalization programs that can, you know, where cities can see an economic return is very important.
What about the mix of stores or the way those stores are operated? When you think about the 45 storefronts of the 60 that you have occupied, mm-hmm. is there some formula you're looking for? I want this percent of restaurants, this percent mm-hmm. of retailers. I want mm-hmm. the restaurants on the corner. I mean, I want them all to open and close at the same hours. What are you thinking about to create an environment that they can't create for themselves?
Well, that certainly is the role of a Main Street program or any kind of credible commercial revitalization program, is to create that kind of planning opportunity. Obviously, you can't control if somebody has a 10-year lease. If it's not the kind of business you would like on that block, it's not a whole lot that you can do about that. But obviously, restaurants like to be where there are other restaurants. Retailers like to be where there are other restaurants. And there certainly is value in clustering because, again, it creates a destination for whatever that good service is. I know in a city in a neighborhood called Adams Morgan, there was a fight between these two pizza places that had located right next to each other. But what it created was just more demand for pizza, you know? People just kept, you know, well, let's go over there because we know there's plenty of pizza.
You know, it's funny. I worked in redevelopment of downtown years ago and owned a retail store, actually, in a downtown area for seven years. But retailers, and I was one, so I can say this, are very much about what is in the cash register when I turn the lights off tonight.
That's right.
And it's very hard sometimes to get them to think about their common interest and how they can help one another and thereby help themselves. It's a very you know, self-interested, narrow view at times.
Yeah, it can be. And I imagine it now. People are trying to do all kinds of things to stay afloat. You know, we've had situations where you'll have one particular kind of store that may sell clothing, and all of a sudden you see a sign that says cell phone plans here, you know, or something where they're trying to do something extra on the side that may not be immediately relative to what their main business is. And I think that that can often hurt retailers. You know, you need to be known for, you know, one or two things and do that very well, and then you create a niche, you know, for yourself.
In a perfect world, what's your vision for the Anacostia Business Corridor? What's the best it can get?
Anacostia certainly has destination potential. We are the home of the Frederick Douglass National Historic Site, which has had up to 70,000 visitors in a year. And so if we were able to give, you know, those tourists, in addition to the residents who are here, other venues while they're here, then I think that we would have a booming corridor, as well as it's trying to serve a niche within the city. Now, 14th Street Northwest is known as the city's furniture district. So it basically came from putting out a press release that it would be so, and then furniture stores started calling and locating there. So ideally for us, finding our niche in the city is certainly a priority, but in the meantime, we are working to upgrade. We've had a lot of kind of fast food carry out places that, you know, had bulletproof glass up. And so we worked with many of those eateries to remove the bulletproof glass and consider putting chairs and tables in, you know, having clear menu boards, clean places. We replaced floors in two of our eateries, you know, things like that. And so others can see growth and decide to locate. There's lots of opportunity here because, you know, there's little competition for several kinds of businesses. For instance, we don't have a hardware store yet. We've had a lot of new residents to move into the neighborhood during the city's real estate boom. A couple years ago, we were the beneficiaries of lots of young urban professionals moving in because, you know, we had such affordable home ownership opportunities right here in the city. We're like 5 minutes from downtown on a drive, and we've got a metro station here. So it's very conveniently located. Most of the homes here have private parking and nice sized lots, you know, which is not very typical in the District of Columbia.
No, it's certainly not. I know that there's been a lot of talk about the Anacostia River and using, redeveloping space along the river. The ballpark was located nearby, right?
Yeah, the ballpark is very close. It is not in our immediate neighborhood. The Anacostia River runs between two neighborhoods, ours, Anacostia, and the end of Capitol Hill, and then beginning of Southwest on the other side.
So what sort of opportunities does that
give you? I know that's what's so confusing. You know, politically it sounded wonderful to talk about all this development on the Anacostia River because people think, oh, it's in Anacostia. And it's not. The river, our community is named after the river, or vice versa, depending on, guess, which historian is telling the story. But that river has two sides, and our side is not the side that has the baseball stadium and all of the big plans. For a while, and I hope that it's still on the table, there was talk about developing Poplar Point, which is on our side of the river, but unfortunately, the city and the developer that had been selected to begin working on the plans have come to a head over funding issues or something. So I'm not quite sure where that is, but, you know, I'm hopeful that talks will begin again. In the meantime, the city soccer team is considering a move to Prince George's County, and they were supposed to be, you know, we were hoping that they were going to be on that land that is on our side of the river, but so.
So you keep working at it.
If
you
that's could, right, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
If you could click your heels three times, get three wishes granted for Main Street, Anacostia, what would they be?
Well, the first thing I would do is to have the young urban professionals that have moved in begin to get together and put together investment teams. Because many neighborhoods get redeveloped because a few neighbors get together and say, hey, we need a coffee shop or we need a this. And so let's put our heads together, or let's put our money together, and let's make this happen. And then, you know, once there begins to be some viability, you can attract some of the more branded retail and restaurant outlets. So that would be the first thing that I would work to do. The next thing I would work to do is, you know, if there was a way to provide more funding to finish some of the things that we were able to start last year in terms of restaurant training. I've laid out this great program. It's a 6-week program for restaurants or eateries in this neighborhood to go through a training program to belong to the American Restaurant Association so that they really understand the industry and, you know, are clued into the trends of the industry and can begin to bring that back and have it reflected in what we're offering here. The other thing, I think storefront improvements are key. Many of our merchants have missed out on business because people look in and they can't tell what it is you do there. Or, you know, you've got bars on the window or big roll-down grate. And so what you're saying is that this is not a safe place to do business. So you keep out people who are unfamiliar with what it is your products and services are because you're not appealing to them. Those are really three areas that we're hoping to be able to work on, you know, with the right funding programs, obviously.
Have you seen the young urban professional investment teams work elsewhere? Or is that an idea you came up with?
I've never seen. I really don't know. I really don't know. All I know is that you've owned your home for 5 years. You've got some equity. So there's money. If the 10 of you could get together, that's enough to start any business. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Let me ask you one more question. Of course, Adolfo Carrion has been named the new director of White House Urban Policy. If you could whisper in his ear and tell him what you think he ought to be focused on in terms of making our cities stronger, what would you tell him?
Well, I would say, number one, be very, very kind to small businesses. Small business is the engine of this country. And so I think the more policies that we can have to support small business, the better. And I'm talking beyond the construction industry, although I do think that that is a good start. Small businesses need tax breaks, tax credits, grants. So, you know, again, small business is more than worth the investment. It also can be a way for someone who may have been on a government subsidy to begin to be self-sufficient or, you know, economically sufficient.
Well, it's been fun to talk with you. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Yavaka Young is the executive director of Main Street Anacostia. Her interview was engineered by Subri Benashur. Finally this week, Walker Smith joins us once again. Our City Views commentator has noticed that the grass does always seem to be greener on the other side.
Recently, my wife and I went to see the latest traveling show of Cirque du Soleil called Cousa. Over the years that Cirque du Soleil has been bringing its 10th show to Atlanta, we've been to every one. And this is one of the best ever. The first time I saw this mix of acrobatics, clowning, and theater, I wanted to run away with this circus. The whole experience was exhilarating. The costumes, the music, the story, the incredible acts. It was an enthralling production that drew me into the moment, and I didn't want it to end. But now that I've been to several Cirque du Soleil shows, I confess that I've become somewhat jaded. It takes a lot to impress me now, but this year's show really stood out. After the Cousa show, my wife and I went home and plopped down on the sofa to watch the end of the AFC Championship game between the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Baltimore Ravens. From one fantasy land to another. The NFL playoffs are another of those public spectacles that show off extraordinary feats of physical talent amidst a staggering display of marketing, promotion, and, yes, its own style of theater. It's not the same kind of scripted theater as professional wrestling, but it is the same kind of personality-driven melodrama that engrosses people and takes them out of themselves and the daily grind for just a little while. But it's not all rapture and euphoria. Behind the scenes, it's not fantasy at all. It's hard work. Nothing but another daily grind with all of the attendant hazards. The night we were there at Coosa, the High Wire star almost fell, saving himself with a one-handed grab as he dropped past the wire. There was a net beneath him, but even with a net, falling is dangerous. He pulled himself up and the show went on, but it was a dodgy moment that temporarily broke the spell of the show. And then later, during the fourth quarter of the AFC Championship game, running back Willis McGahee of the Baltimore Ravens was carted off the field after an accidental helmet-to-helmet collision with Pittsburgh Steelers safety Ryan Clark. Both players were shaken up on the play, but McGahee was put on a backboard and taken off immediately for further observation. He's okay now, but the shock of that moment was visible on the field as McGahee's teammate, linebacker Ray Lewis, kneeled nearby with his head down and his eyes closed as if in prayer for McGahee. These sorts of things happen a lot in circuses and football, so maybe I'm just making too much of it, but it occurs to me that there really is no magic. We give ourselves over to the illusion of superhuman performances and out-of-this-world transformations, but illusion is all it is. Even escape takes work. Every illusion is work, not magic, and this work comes with all of the accompanying occupational hazards. We can get away for a while, but we can never get away clean. We can never really run away with the circus. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trends service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His latest book is Generation Ageless. There's a lot more Smart City on our website. Join us at smartcityradio.com to sign up for our newsletter and subscribe to our podcast. You can also contact us and let us know how we're doing. Click on the contact button or send us an email at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, and national distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer, engineer, and resident Shakespearean scholar, and that is not a joke. I'm Carol Coletta.